What a fine morning. It is a joy to move freely in the world, to walk without caution on the sidewalks, to hear the voices of birds and frogs. Have you heard the peepers yet? See the flutter of bats in the evening light. It is a joy to feel our own bodies, our own innermost animal selves called to life again with the greening of spring. And this morning, we have a great joy to have Colleen O'Connell with us. She has been leading a workshop this weekend in three parts, starting Friday morning at Riverwoods, yesterday all day here, and then again this afternoon. Doing that work for this workshop is the work that reconnects us to the earth and to each other and to our own souls. That is the work that we are here to do in this spiritual community as well. Reconnect ourselves to that deepest pull of life. At the end of our service, Colleen will share a story and a dance with us from halfway around the world. And you will be invited to join us outside for this dance that honors the earth and honors our relationship with our fellow humans. If you don't wish to dance, I hope that you will still come out to our empty lot and watch and listen. We have some chairs out there. Colleen will tell us the story of that dance later in the service, and that story may touch your heart and maybe embolden you to dance no matter what. We come here to this circle of people to listen, to deepen our souls, to be welcomed and to be challenged. Come into this tough beauty of spring. Colleen O'Connell will light our chalice this morning, and I invite you to join in the words of our covenant, which are printed in the order of service. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest for truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve humanity in fellowship, to respect the nurturing power within all of us. Covenant. We will sing our young people and their leaders out to Young Church. Our young people will join us for this dance, and parents will meet them in the parish hall as we head out to the empty lot later. This month of April that holds Earth Day in it, we chose to reflect on how we understand ourselves as humans in relationship to the whole world around us, how we have an ecological identity, an identity that includes the Earth in all of its variety. This poem is one that I wrote back in 2008 after hearing a news story that you may remember, or after I describe it, you may have that sense of deja vu about it. The story was that a small plane was flying over a very remote part of the Amazon rainforest and photographed some indigenous people living there who people were not aware of having being still there. They were as yet had not yet had contact with the world that we know about and live in and assume everyone is connected to. So this is a poem about, well, my response to that news story about a plane flying over these people living a very different life on this same planet. It was just a few pictures, and then the plane went on, leaving behind a story of itself, the roar, the metal, the reflection of the sunlight. They did not know that the plane recorded their faces, intent, their bodies, painted yellow and red, moving quickly through their village, suddenly gone strange. They point their spears and longbows at the airplane, and though they are afraid of that noise in the sky, they meet it. They are splendid and fierce, even at a distance. What we know about them, they are ready to defend themselves. They know the pigments of their land and cover themselves with them. They live in shelters made of branches and leaves. They do not have planes. Contact with people who do have planes will almost surely kill them, one way or another. A year later, I return to the photos and find that although I remember their eyes, in the picture their faces aren't clear. The distance from the plane to the ground has smudged their living. It makes me lonely. I don't want to be a threat to anyone. I don't want to have to keep my distance. I don't want the faces and the eyes to blur in the speed of this life. I want something simple that is lost when you are a people who build planes. I want my body back, like the soil in the thawing garden. I want to feel the trees and the rivers and the calling birds on my skin and in my bones. I want my mind to be free from my skull, ranging freely in this world. We are connected to each other, connected to lives we don't even consciously know about. Some of that connection is indeed halfway around the world, and some of that connection is down the street, and we don't know how intimately we affect each other, neighbor to neighbor. So this morning, we also hear from some people who are remembering how important we are to each other close at hand in things that we don't see always close at hand. We have two people here from 68 Hours of Hunger this morning, Sue Abizade and Kim Army, who will talk a little bit about their program and how we can notice some things right in our own neighborhoods.
Thank you, Kendra. Good morning. Kim and I are so happy to be back again this year, and we appreciate the invitation to be here on Give It Away Sunday and the opportunity to tell you about the program that we are running in Exeter called N68 Hours of Hunger. Childhood hunger is a nearly invisible problem, and yet in every community in America, including our own, there are kids who are hungry for 68 hours. From the time they get their free lunch at school on Friday to the free breakfast they receive in school on Monday morning. Our program aims to alleviate this period of hunger by providing kids with a backpack of food to get them through the weekend. N68 Hours of Hunger is a New Hampshire-based program whose mission is to end childhood hunger in America, one school at a time. It was started in 2011 by a woman named Claire Bloom in the Dover school system. In 4 years, the program has quickly grown to include 30 towns in 6 different states, serving over 1,400 kids every week. The Exeter N68 program was started a little bit over 2 years ago when Kim and I learned that there were kids right here in our own SAU 16 community who were hungry on the weekends. Our first week, which I believe was in February, a little over 2 years ago, we delivered 4 backpacks. And last year when I was here speaking to you, we were delivering about 67 backpacks every week to all the elementary schools in SAU 16. And this year, the number has grown to 90, having added the cooperative middle school and the high school this past year. So 90 kids who are food insecure on the weekend right in our own community, which is sad to think about. But we work closely with all the schools within SAU 16. It's a confidential program. We don't know who the children are who are receiving the backpacks, but the school nurses and the guidance counselors determine the need. They give us a number, which you know, sometimes fluctuates from week to week, but they keep us abreast of the numbers. And then they distribute the backpacks discreetly every Friday through the schools. So the school nurses and guidance counselors have been a great resource to help with the program. And Kim's going to tell you a little bit more.
Well, one of the reasons that we started giving food to the high school children is we were providing to middle schoolers starting at the end of last year. And those middle schoolers that moved to high school actually went to the nurse and asked if they could still participate in the program. So I think that just shows how much this food means to them for a high schooler to be willing to go and get that. And school nurses have told us that, you know, in the winter, kids always forget their hats and mittens. They've never once forgotten to come and get their backpack. So I just think this food is really important to these kids. Children who are hungry in school are lethargic. They have trouble learning. They're disruptive in the class. And when you go into the classrooms now, the classes are quiet. The kids are actually learning. Studies have shown that children that are fed have 50% higher reading scores and 30% higher math scores. And they're twice as likely to complete the third grade, which is a leading indicator of high school graduation. Our backpacks, we have a sample out back of what we provide, but there's about 7,000 calories in the backpack, so there's enough there to share if there are other people in the family that are hungry. If a family has 2 children in our school system that are hungry, they get 2 backpacks, but you know, if there's younger kids, we don't know, obviously, about those, so that it can be shared. And we have a great group of ladies who live in this area somewhere that we call the Fruit Ladies, and they bring us 2 pieces of fruit every week for the backpacks. So that's about 180 pieces of fruit that they go and buy with their own money every week, which is a great addition to our backpack. Other than that, we put in mostly non-perishables because, you know, we don't know if the kids are going to pick up the backpack each week. We can't have food going bad. We have a great group of volunteers, about 100 volunteers, actually, and we have 8 teams that come in and they pack backpacks each week, and then they deliver to the schools, and they go back the following week and pick up the empty backpacks. We are 100% volunteer organization, so every dollar that is donated is used only to purchase food. Anything else, like buying backpacks, the paper we printed this on, we pay for that out of our own pockets. We do get backpacks donated as well, and we take anything that's gently used. It costs about $10 to fill a backpack, so we have a budget of about $900 a week or $36,000 a year. So any contributions are always greatly appreciated. Anything else? Oh, we have, I left it on the bench, but we have a group called Feeding Children Everywhere that makes little packets of rice and beans, and they donated 5,000 of these packets for us. So there'll be one on the back table, but we have been able to add that to our backpack this year, which is a great little addition, nice and healthy, better than the mac and cheese.
And we just wanted to say thank you to all of you who were here last year who donated not only food but monetary donations that were put to use right away, helping all of these local kids who are in need. So we appreciate your great support, and again, your invitation to come back again this year. And we will be at coffee hour. If anybody has any questions, we'd be more than happy to talk to you further about N68 Hours of Hunger.
And thank you for having us.
Thank you.
There is a basket up front if you saw the announcement about bringing tangible donations for the program today. There are also candles available up front. There are two bowls on this side, so you can form one line coming down the side here and light candles in two places here, because our choir is going to share music with us during this offering time. The morning offering for End 68 Hours of Hunger will now be received. When we are busy with our human lives, we can forget that our lives are held by many other lives that aren't human. Those trees around us these days that are coming back to life. I love to watch the maples as they get just red at the tips of their branches, and then the green comes behind. All of those lives hold our lives too. So as our joys and sorrows rise and fall away, it helps to remember that we are always held in something larger. So if you come here this morning with joy or sorrow in your own life, speak it aloud here with this circle of beings, knowing that we are held in something even larger. I will stand here by the piano with our microphone. Come and stand with me if you have a piece of your story to share.
I'm John Giglio. I returned yesterday from 5 days visiting my daughter in Buffalo. Told you a week or so ago that she's engaged. And I met my future son-in-law for the first time. And Alicia and Andrew are tickled pink, as am I, after meeting him. My daughter can be a little emotional. I can't imagine where she gets this from. But anyway, Jim, her fiancé, is just about as calm as you can be. He's the recipient of 7 Purple Hearts as an Army Ranger. So nothing faces him. He's amazing, and it's great. I'm really happy about it.
I'm Dawn Huebner. Most of you know I'm a child psychologist, and I write self-help books for kids. After a relatively long stretch of not writing, I'm happy to report that I've completed a manuscript for another book, tentatively titled From Worrier to Warrior, A Kid's Guide to Facing Fear. And although standing up here in front of you with a microphone is not my favorite thing to do, it's good practice for me because I've just been invited to give a TED Talk, and that will be coming up. Thank you. That'll be coming up at the end of May.
Good morning. I just wanted to say, I'm Herb Moyer. I just wanted to say what a joy it was to work with Colleen and all of you who were present at yesterday's event, and I'm really looking forward to the rest of it today. Thank you.
I'm Barbara Richards. I had a special joy yesterday when I went to Concord to hear the song weavers sing my song, which fits into today's service, I think. It starts out, "Rejoice, rejoice, the froggies sing." And it starts with peepers. I heard several people told me they had heard peepers already, which I haven't, and it ends up with the bullfrog sings chugga chugga rum. So, just for a bit of fun.
Hello, I'm Warren Seeke, and I actually took my daughter Celeste to the Exeter Woods yesterday, and the peepers were just cacophony. I'm not sure if I pronounced that right. But so my joy is that, as some people might know, I work for a Danish shoe company that has an office in Amsterdam, and I found out this week that I'm going to take my family to Amsterdam for 5 weeks while I'm working over there. So that's, and I when I was small, my father would spend some summers in Switzerland, and we went over there and stayed there, and I think that made a profound impact on me, and I'm really looking forward to having my children spend 5 weeks in another country outside the United States.
Good morning, I'm Liz Reyes, and since everyone's sharing joys, this is probably a process that started over 35 years ago. I started running when I was 10 years old. I was never good at it, but always loved it. And then I followed Bill Rogers' running career in Boston. And then as an undergraduate at Boston College, I loved Marathon Monday because I could get out of school, cheer on the runners, always with the beer in hand. They never did accept one being offered. And then after a process of never thinking it, I could do it, finally working for a couple of years to qualify, got a number, and after one heck of a winter training season, we'll cross the line with the 20 to 30 mile an hour winds and the rain's coming down, but like every other runner out there. So a process will come and culminate tomorrow.
It's wonderful to hear about our congregation out there in the world. And we know for all of these stories about people stepping out bravely into the world, there are many stories that are unfolding in our hearts that aren't ready or maybe never will be spoken aloud. We honor what is spoken and what is unspoken. I invite you into a time of meditation with these questions. Those peepers who are peeping are little inch-long frogs that live in cold water, and they sing. These frogs can, in fact, freeze and then defrost and keep singing. It would be unbelievably harsh for us to live their lives. And they keep singing. What sorrow do you need to be able to sit right down in the middle of and not fix it or drain it away, but just be in it? What song do you need or want to sing, no matter how cold the water. Colleen carries with her, well, many stories. But this story in particular that is the prelude to the Elm Dance. She told me that in order for us to dance the Elm Dance, a promise had been made to the people who taught that dance, that their story would always be told before the dance was danced. So Colleen will tell us that story, and I invite you to come forward to do that.
It's great to be here. I love that in just a few days I can look out and see many new friends' faces here. This feels like a fabulous church. I'm tempted to drive an hour and a half from Vermont to come here on Sunday mornings. Maybe I'll do it on occasion. But thank you for your welcome. Thank you, Stephanie and Jim, for opening your home to me. And I've had a really rich experience since Friday morning at 9 o'clock. So this actually is like two stories. The song that we're going to dance to is Latvian. And it was recorded and sung in Latvia in the 80s, prior to the Soviet Union breaking up. And it's a song about trees. And it's a song about trees blooming and branching out and spring arriving. But the underneath story of that song is that it became a resistance song for the Latvian people who were really wishing for freedom from the Soviet Union and to have their country back. And so it became an embedded revolutionary song that got sung at their rallies for freedom from the Soviet Union. So it went to the top of the charts, and any Latvian person who hears this song immediately rejoices in their freedom to be Latvia again. So Joanna Macy, who is the founder of the work that reconnects that we did in workshops here this weekend, she was introduced to this in Germany, actually, the song and the dance, and she started using it in her work. Her husband, Fran Macy, who most people in the United States have never heard of, but Fran was a director in the Peace Corps in India and Asian countries and ended up ultimately in Russia, which was his love because he majored in Russian studies as an undergraduate. And so he was the head of the Russian Peace Corps, and in the process started, after his Peace Corps stint, started a major environmental group in Russia. And not unlike Sierra Club in this country. So he was well known in Russia and worked to train and work with activists in Russia to deal with the environmental degradation and atrocities that were happening in that country. So, of course, when Chernobyl happened, when that nuclear power plant melted down, all the activists in Russia that Fran had been working with were, of course, alerted and, you know, came together in support of the people who were impacted incredibly by that event. And so in the years following Chernobyl, Fran would often work with the activists to figure out what they could do for these communities that were radiated, basically. And at one point, they decided to bring Joanna, who was doing the work to reconnect, in with Fran to go around to various cities, small cities, in the Bryansk region of Russia, where a lot of the radiation fell out, and to offer workshops in order for people to reconnect with themselves, because there was such a numbness that had happened in the event of that experience. So Joanna didn't speak Russian. Her husband Fran did. But using translators, she came in, and she's a pretty vivacious woman and, you know, just gets people going and talking and emoting. And so she brought these Russian people together in an elementary school in a gymnasium, and anything she tried, she was met with just stone-cold faces. They didn't even use the word Chernobyl or nuclear reactive, you know, meltdown. They called it the event. Since the event, they would say very, you know, we don't talk about things. Since the event, you know, we, and so she, her work is to get us to really get back in touch with our heart and to not block and not numb ourselves, but instead to share and to be in our grief, to honor that pain, but to move through it so that we can come out and do work in the world that is freed from, you know, this emotional stuckness. So she was pulling her hair out. It's like, how can I get these people to respond? How can I get them to start talking about this atrocity and sharing with each other? You know, some of the families were leaving to run and visit their children in the hospital that were dying of leukemia. And they'd come back and just, you know, and then the father would leave, and then he'd be there for a couple hours, and then the mother would leave. And she was witnessing this and thinking, how can I get them to start sharing their grief? So finally, she decided to offer this Elm dance that she had learned in Germany, where people gather, and it's, you know, some of you might be worried that you're being asked to dance in the yard today. It's really a meditative walk. It's a very simple, you know, procedure of walking and meditating in a circle as a sacred circle experience. So let me calm your fears about that. And she decided that she would offer that. And many Russian people knew Latvian language and knew the song because, of course, it was popular all over the Soviet Union. So she put the music on and she taught them the steps and they did the dance. And they started to hold their hands up, which wasn't part of the dance, in order for the trees to be signified as swaying. And you'll see that in the dance. These were the people of a community of Novozibkov. And in the atrocity that happened there is when the radiation cloud that was exploding out of Chernobyl started to go into the atmosphere. The wind shift, and it was heading northeast toward Moscow. And the people of the Soviet Union realized, or the government realized, that Moscow had rain predicted, and this cloud was going to land in Moscow at the time the rain was probably going to hit, and millions of people in Moscow would be radiated. So they made the immediate choice to seed the clouds, the radiation cloud that was leaving Chernobyl, so that it would drop into the countryside before hitting Moscow. They made that decision and never informed the people of the Bryansk region. And so unbeknownst to them, when it started to rain, they were getting huge amounts of radiation raining down on them. And they weren't even informed that that had happened for months afterwards. So people started getting sick, and they had no idea why. So once they learned it, of course, their children were dying, people were getting leukemia. It was difficult, and since then, of course, babies are being born deformed. And the other really sad thing for the people of Novozibkov is they were an agriculture area and also a woodlands community and culture. So the forest was the place that they went for their recreation. Many people made their living in the forest, logging, using the wood. And have in your mind this image of beautiful Russian houses with painted doors and, crafted windows and bright turquoise and reds and colors. These were their houses. And what we know is that radiation sinks into wood and is stored there. So many of these houses had to be razed and just completely demolished. People got put in concrete slab apartments, and the roads into the woods and the forests were shut down. They could no longer go into their woods and celebrate and picnic and take their children hiking. So not only were they sickened, but they had lost their culture and their homes. And it was an atrocity that really the world did not know about. And so here was Joanna in front of these people trying to get them 4 or 5 years later to talk about it. Can we deal with this? And for them, it was like they had so numbed themselves to this reality that they couldn't. What happened in dancing the Elm Dance is they started to melt. So they started to dance. They added the swaying trees, and that's how they ended the day. The next morning when she came, they wanted to do the dance. And so she put the music on. They wanted to do it again. She put the music on again, and they wanted to do it again. And finally, they started to talk. And they talked, and they shared, and they told their stories, and they shared what was happening to their children, to their homes. And then at the end, Joanna remembers vividly the next day they were leaving. So it was like the last day. They waited 5 days. And they, that happens sometimes. You wait till the very end, and then you kind of burst. So they waited till this last day to really start talking. And at the end of the day, this big Russian woman got up, Anna, and she looked at Joanna and she goes, "How dare you have done this to us? You came here, you incited us to begin talking about it. Our grief is huge. You've opened us up, and now you get to go back to America. And we're left here, and the world doesn't know what happened." And Joanna, feeling very guilty at that point, looked at them and said, "I will dance this dance, and I will tell your story every time it's danced. And everybody I teach this dance to, I will ask them to tell your story." So that, in fact, the people of Novozibkov will not be forgotten. And what goes on there still goes on there. We're talking thousands of years. Thousands of, many, many generations before they will be able to enter that forest again. So today we're going to dance the Elm Dance in honor of the people of Novozibkov to help them know that they are not forgotten, that such environmental atrocities that are happening around the world, that this congregation of people care, and that you're working, all of you, in whatever way you can to alleviate this kind of thing happening. So we're going to do it twice. The first time we're going to dance for the people of Novozibkov, and the second time we're going to dance for us in celebration of spring. And so the tape will play once. We'll go out. I'll teach the dance. We'll dance for the people of Novozibkov, and then there'll be a break, Just simple pause, the music will start again, and we will dance for the celebration of spring that we have happening around us. So we can leave on a spring happy note today. When we dance that dance, I want you to call out that which you love most in the world. And you just call it into the circle as a way to celebrate who we are in this world, in our connection. So the paradox is we need to hold the sorrow of what happens in our world and the incredible joy of what it means to be alive on this planet. And you're invited in to live the paradox, because in fact and indeed that's what we have to do. So thank you for letting me offer this story in this dance. And if we just go out, we've set up some chairs. If you do not want to participate, elders, people, that please sit in a chair and you'll be able to watch the circle around you, and you will be the heart of our group and the heart of the dance, okay? So you will be a participant. And also, Herb is going to video it. So it should be a beautiful thing. And any questions that I can answer for anybody before we head out?
I'll give a little more
direction. Okay, she'll give a little more direction. Thank you.
Doug, as the usher, could you go and gather the children? I think they're waiting in the parish hall for us, and maybe you could just bring them here to meet us instead of us going to meet them. Thank you. I think we'll go out this front door and then go out to the our open space on the corner. If you need help walking there, will you either grab someone next to you or just stay where you are, and we will gather you up as people are headed out to make sure that everyone has steady footing out there. And there are chairs to sit in out there. If you either don't feel steady enough to dance, walk meditatively in our open space, or just don't wish to. Both of those are fine choices. I invite you, also the choir will sing a little bit to carry us out the door so that we can keep a sense of meditation as we go out into the sunshine. Please join us in the dance.